Abigail Lloyd, but the gum was found by police attached to the shell casing, thereby rendering Hernandez's DNA on the shell casing useless. This provided the defense with good arguments attacking the sloppy police work, but it should never have seen the light of day in a courtroom. I believe the judge should have excluded this evidence because the DNA results were meaningless, and this only served to confuse the jury. I do not believe the defense challenged this in pretrial hearings. I would have tried to exclude it. 2:33 a.m. Surveillance video from a camera at a home across the street from Lloyd's house on Faiston Street in Boston shows Lloyd getting into the car with Hernandez, Wallace, and Ortiz. 3:07 a.m. Lloyd texts his sister, Shaquila Tibu. You saw who I'm with? 3:11 a.m. Lloyd texts Tibu again. Hello? 3:19 a.m. Tibu texts back. My phone was dead. Who was that? Lloyd responds, NFL. Tibu later tells police she understood NFL meant Hernandez. 3:22 a.m. Tibu texts Lloyd again. LOL, you're Aggie. Meaning Lloyd was aggravating her. 3:23 a.m. Lloyd sent his last text to Tibu. Just so you know. All of the text messages to Lloyd's sister were excluded by the judge in pretrial. About 3:25 a.m., Lloyd is shot and killed in an industrial park roughly a half mile from Hernandez's home. 3:26 a.m., the Altima returns to Hernandez's home. Hernandez was driving. 3:27 a.m., home surveillance video shows Hernandez, Wallace, and Ortiz entering through the garage. Many people ask me, do you believe Aaron Hernandez shot Odin Lloyd? Well, I can tell you Aaron told me he did not. My honest answer, despite the fact that I knew Aaron, represented him in the Boston case, and even liked him, is I don't know for certain. However, after examining the case and how it was tried, I have a reasonable doubt that he did it. Now let me show you why. First and foremost, many people do not know that Aaron Hernandez was tried on what is known as the joint venture theory, a legal loophole that allows prosecutors to hold someone liable for murder, even if they don't know they are the person who did the actual killing. Huh? Yes, that's right. A person can be convicted of murder even if the prosecutor cannot prove they did it. Bristol County prosecutors went on a dual theory in this case. They believed Aaron was the shooter, but weren't sure enough to charge him on that theory alone. Dual theories to me scream reasonable doubt. I tell juries all the time, under the law, you are not to guess what happened or figure out a mystery. The government must prove beyond and to the exclusion of every reasonable doubt. It is the highest legal standard in American jurisprudence. To understand the reasonable doubt standard, you have to compare it with other legal standards. A lower standard of a preponderance of the evidence is the criterion for a verdict in civil cases. This is the only standard quantified at 51%, meaning if the case is proven 51% in one direction, jurors must render their verdict for that side. In some evidentiary proceedings, there is clear and convincing evidence, which is still lower than beyond a reasonable doubt. Now think about that for a second. If you don't know who the shooter is, how in the hell is the evidence proven beyond a reasonable doubt? Think of the injustice of being convicted of murder when the prosecutor in your case doesn't even have to prove you pulled the trigger. Most defenses counter the joint venture theory by arguing what is called mere presence, which means that a person, under the law, cannot be convicted of a crime just because they are merely present when a crime occurs, even if they knew it was about to occur. People who are present aren't forced to act and put their own life in danger. Otherwise, we might have more casualties. To be convicted, the accused must have participated in the crime and had the intent to commit it. Now that you understand the framework of the law the jury had to follow, let me walk you through the evidence as it was presented in court. The prosecution was extremely weak on motive, so what do they do when they don't have motive? They throw everything against the wall to see what sticks. In this case, the prosecution provided the following motives. First, that Aaron was angry at Odin because when they went out a few days before the murder, Aaron saw Odin talking to some of his friends at the Rumor nightclub, and that made Aaron so mad he killed him. Yes, I'm serious. That was their best motive. They spent days playing video from inside and outside Rumor, showing various interactions, trying to show an angry Aaron as he contemplated killing Odin for talking to a friend of his. Complicating this theory was the fact that after that night, Aaron had loaned Odin a Chevy Suburban to drive around Boston, despite being enraged enough to kill him. By the way, Rumor is part of the same ownership as Cure, but in this case, all videos were properly obtained without incident. The second motive prosecutors put forth was that after partying that night, Odin and Aaron took Aaron's babysitter and her sister to the apartment the Patriots helped him rent for his safety. They spent the night there after the babysitter refused Aaron's advances, the theory being that Odin might have told Shayana about Aaron hitting on another woman. This was absurd, considering Shayana is no fool. She is not only an intelligent woman, but she also totally knew that Aaron the celebrity athlete was not the poster boy of fidelity. Plus, under that theory, Aaron would have had to kill off the babysitter too, right? Finally, they even had Alexander Bradley testify that on one occasion, while at Aaron's house, Odin and Shayana's sister Shania came into the house and walked upstairs without saying hello, and Aaron remarked that it was rude. This encounter would somehow enrage Aaron several months later and motivate him to hang out with Odin a few times and then kill him. The lack of real motive was a gaping hole in the prosecution's case. Aaron's lawyers did a decent job of attacking this weakness at closing arguments, but I'm not sure if the point was hammered enough throughout the trial. What does all of this evidence show? It basically shows that four guys went into a gravel pit and three came out, but only one gun was used. That means you only have one shooter. The prosecution could never prove who it was, so they tried to paint Aaron as the ringleader, thereby arguing that if he didn't shoot Lloyd, he participated by organizing the outing and driving him to the gravel pit. He was also the only one shown on video with a gun at his house. Sounds pretty damning, but let me poke a few holes in this thing so you can see the reasonable doubt. You first have the so-called organizing of it all. There was zero evidence showing when and how the criminal intent was formulated. Without a motive, as I mentioned earlier, it's anyone's guess what these four guys were going to do that night and at what point things turned to murder. That's huge. The prosecutor argued that they were going to Aaron's house. Well, that indicates innocence. Why do all this elaborate organizing only to bring the police to your front door? The more logical explanation is these guys got in the car, realized it was too late to go to a club, so they decided to go to Aaron's house and chill in the man cave. Hanging out in a mansion was quite a treat for these guys, so the idea is not far-fetched. Why stop at the gravel pit? Maybe they wanted to go somewhere private and get high. Ortiz and Wallace were known to use PCP, which Aaron would not have done considering the NFL penalties for using PCP would have astronomical consequences. He could have been suspended for up to 4 games without pay. Aaron would also not want anyone using it in the house in case Shayana walked in on it. There's also the possibility that something happened on the way to Aaron's house. Perhaps a dispute between Lloyd and another member of the group. Who? That would be for the prosecutor to prove. But if some conflict had indeed erupted, how do we know they didn't pull over to fight it out and someone took out a gun and shot Lloyd? You see, without motive or any evidence of intent, these are two very plausible scenarios. Had they been considered, jurors would have had a hard time convicting not only Aaron, but also Wallace and Ortiz. You can't just say Aaron had the opportunity to kill Lloyd and that's why he's guilty. No, you have to show either incriminating statements made by Aaron or some type of forensic evidence that ties Aaron to the murder weapon, and the critical gum on the shell casing doesn't cut it. What helped the prosecution the most was their video evidence, much of which Aaron provided through the cameras in his home. But the pink elephant in the room was Alexander Bradley. No one knew what was going on between Aaron and Bradley. The defense had to make a strategic call here to exclude any mention of what happened in West Palm Beach and, of course, Boston. So the jury would never hear the reason Aaron had this elaborate surveillance system in his house was because he feared Bradley killing him, Shayana, and the baby. They would never hear the reason Aaron was going everywhere with Ernest Bo Wallace and Carlos Ortiz was because he needed backup. The reason Aaron had armed himself with a gun wherever he went was because he feared being lit up by bullets at any moment by Bradley and his henchmen. Instead, the prosecution seized this as an opportunity to paint Aaron as a gun-toting thug who hung around unsavory characters when he had the world at his fingertips. That's the image most of America had of Aaron Hernandez. There was also footage of Aaron holding a gun before he left that night and after he returned. On the face of it, the video was a blow to the defense. They tried arguing that Aaron was actually holding an iPad or a phone or a remote control. This, I think, was a mistake. You instantly lose credibility with a jury when you try to mislead them in this way. The defense was in a bind here because they wanted to protect Aaron by excluding all the Bradley business. But it was the Bradley saga that explained much of the behavior that made him look guilty. Therefore, much of the evidence presented by the prosecution went unrebutted and out of context. The jury did not know that after the Bradley War began, Aaron always armed himself before he left his home. A jury trial is about the prosecution and defense painting two different pictures of the accused and how his personality, circumstances, and actions played out during the event in question. Without understanding why Aaron had extra protection, guns, and cameras, and with no background about why he might have acted the way he did, jurors could assume this was just who he was. Now add the media's focus on lurid details and their tabloid spin to the story, and you have the perfect storm for a conviction, evidence be damned. The jury was not sequestered in this case, and Bristol County is a small area. Aaron didn't stand a chance. I don't criticize the defense for excluding this information. I am not sure they had much choice. It was pick your poison. Let Bradley tell his story, or exclude him altogether. They chose the latter, and it didn't work out. The prosecution also submitted a couple of uncharged crimes into evidence when they put on evidence, and these too struck me as missed opportunities for the defense. Right after getting back from West Palm Beach, Aaron sent money to some of the guys he met down in Florida to transport some guns up to Massachusetts so he could arm himself against Bradley's weaponry. This load of illegal guns came in as evidence, but no one knew why Aaron was buying guns. None of this was relevant to whether or not he shot Odin Lloyd, but prosecutors needed to paint Aaron as a thug, and the war with Bradley gave them all the ammo they needed, literally. When I saw the illegal gun buy, I thought the opposite. If Aaron was such a gangster thug, why would he need to get guns from Florida from guys he just met? Shouldn't he be able to get plenty of guns from the guys he knew in Bristol? This showed me that Aaron was an amateur bad guy, and I was reminded of one of my favorite lines from HBO's Boardwalk Empire when Jimmy Darmody tells Nucky Thompson, "You can't be half a gangster." Aaron's sloppiness could only come from someone who had no idea what he was doing in the violent world of guns and murder. You might be thinking, I'm sorry, but being in and around two shootings is too much of a coincidence. However, most people who live outside the turbulent world of guns and drugs have no idea just how frequently shootings happen. It is not uncommon at all for someone with Aaron's background to be in a few shootouts. Odds are that eventually one of those bullets hits you and you're not around to see any more shootings unless you have nine lives. Or, your name is Alexander Bradley. Chapter 14. Prison Life. At 8:45 a.m. on June 26, 2013, about a dozen officers and detectives from the Massachusetts State Police and North Attleboro Police arrived at Aaron Hernandez's home in North Attleboro, Massachusetts. Seven of them walked up to the door. One of them knocked. Aaron and Shayana were in their bedroom playing with Aviel. Shayana was still in her nightgown. Aaron was wearing gym shorts with no shirt or shoes. They were enjoying a leisurely morning at home until they heard the knock at the door. Aaron answered, not expecting these would be his final moments as a free man. The police, with looks of self-satisfaction, announced they were there to arrest him for the murder of Odin Lloyd. They let him put on a pair of black sneakers but didn't wait for him to put on a shirt before handcuffing his wrists behind his back while reading him his Miranda rights. The plainclothes cops then stretched a V-neck T-shirt over his head before escorting him out of his home. Television crews that had been camped outside his home for several days finally captured the moment they had been waiting for. One detective held his right arm while another detective held his left arm as Aaron was walked to a police cruiser. He had no emotion on his face. Yet, in a last act of defiance, he spat on the side of the road before getting in the police cruiser. The arrest that was national news came 9 days after Lloyd's body was found by a nighttime jogger in an industrial park less than a mile from Aaron's home. The police had spent those 9 days building their case against Aaron, the star tight end for the Patriots. They had searched his home multiple times, police dogs had sniffed around his property, and scuba divers had checked a nearby pond. The search warrants needed to do all this became public knowledge as the media was fed every update that pointed to Aaron as a suspect. As helicopters tracked his arrival, he was taken to the North Attleboro Police Department for booking as media began feasting on the storyline of a rich athlete blowing it all by committing a heinous offense. The video of his arrest was played worldwide, much to the satisfaction of homicide detectives working the case. They could have arranged for Aaron to turn himself in. Very commonly, as a professional courtesy, arrangements are made well in advance to allow high-profile suspects to turn themselves in privately. I do not know Michael Fee, who became Aaron's attorney when the police first began questioning him as a primary suspect. Everything I know about him and how smart he is tells me this was done behind his back. The very public, publicized arrest was just the kind of Bush League move that would be made by amateur cops looking for their 15 minutes of fame. Everything I have seen come out of Bristol County since then has shown me that this small town held the limelight and let media interest dictate the way they conducted business. The way Aaron was arrested is a perfect example. As ministers of justice, prosecutors are also charged with protecting the integrity of the system, including the presumption of innocence. Knowing full well that cameras were rolling and a media blitz would sway public opinion, they should have allowed Aaron to turn himself in. The fact that they didn't reveals a win-at-all-costs mentality that should give everyone pause. If they allowed a man who should have been presumed innocent until proven guilty to be arrested with such fanfare in front of the whole world, imagine the things done in lesser-known cases where no one is watching. The following day in a courthouse in Fall River, Massachusetts, Aaron's attorneys James Sultan and Michael Fee argued that Aaron should be released on $250,000 bail. They pointed out that he had no prior criminal record of any kind, that he grew up in Bristol, Connecticut, and that he was a professional who had devoted much of his time and energy to playing football. They also pointed out that he was a homeowner with a fiancé and the father of a young child. Judge Renee Dupuy didn't want to hear it. Her demeanor implied that she had already passed judgment on Aaron based on the circumstantial evidence. The facts, as they've been presented to me, if believed by a jury, is that this gentleman, either by himself or with two other people that he requested come to the Commonwealth, basically in a cold-blooded fashion killed a person because that person disrespected him. And if that's true, and based on the presentation it seems to be, I'm confident that type of individual obviously doesn't comply with societal rules, and the idea that I release him on a bracelet and he would comply with court rules is not something that I'm willing to accept. She added, he also has a means to flee, and a bracelet just wouldn't keep him here. As I reviewed the case and watched video of Judge Dupuy denying the defense's motion for bail, I was especially stunned by her comment, if that's true, and based on the presentation it seems to be. What happened to the right to the presumption of innocence, or innocent until proven guilty? Judge Dupuy was telling everyone, including a potential jury pool, that based on the evidence she had seen, it seems to be true that Aaron Hernandez committed the crime for which he had been charged. She totally disregarded the fact that Aaron was from Bristol, had not left Bristol when he was named a suspect, had cooperated with every search warrant, had recently purchased a home, and had an 8-month-old daughter he adored. Instead, she not only said he was basically guilty, but that he would likely flee and put him in jail until the trial. The obvious fact is that home confinement would have been absolutely effective in this case, as the media was parked outside his home and he was clearly a recognizable figure. He couldn't step outside without 20 cameras trained on him. The purpose of bail is to ensure someone's appearance for court, not to punish the accused. Establishing bail is really the system's first opportunity to show the presumption of innocence is a living and breathing constitutional right, not just some obscure theory. But not a word was said about the judge's inflammatory ruling, and Aaron spent every night for the rest of his life behind bars. The denial of bail puts a great hardship on the defense team as well, especially in a high-profile murder case where such things as text messages and cell phone usage would play such crucial roles. Instead of having full access to a client who can help in clarifying things and preparing for trial, preparation is limited to select hours during jailhouse visits under the eyes and ears of the corrections department. If that wasn't bad enough, the boss of the Bristol County Jail near Dartmouth was a publicity-seeking sheriff named Thomas Hodgson. With his white slicked back hair and bushy white mustache, Hodgson took full advantage of the media interest that came with Aaron's arrest. He agreed to multiple interviews and gave a half dozen personal tours of the jail where Aaron was sent after his 2013 arrest, and even after he was transferred to the Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center in 2015. He even speculated on Aaron's mental health. A diehard Republican appointed sheriff in 1997, Hodgson was in charge of about 1,000 inmates when Aaron arrived, most of them either awaiting trial or serving 2-year sentences or less. He fancied himself to be the toughest jailer in Massachusetts, an old-school lawman whose way of administrating jailhouse justice bordered on archaic. This is a guy who over the years intentionally made sure meals were bland and unsatisfying, and who in 1999 instituted a chain gang work crew, shackling inmates when they worked in the community picking up trash. He cut coffee and orange juice from the budget and eliminated televisions, weightlifting equipment, and smoking from the jails. In 2002, he started charging inmates rent of $5 per day until a judge overruled him in 2004. Hodgson, an elected official, was as much a salesman as a sheriff. He never met a camera he didn't like and didn't hesitate to toot his own horn. He took every opportunity to bolster his tough guy image by telling reporters how unpleasant Aaron's life was behind bars with all of its restrictions. While other sheriffs tried to rehabilitate inmates through education and improving self-esteem, Hodgson preferred the tough love approach, saying it was an appropriate way to discourage children from a life of crime. Perhaps most galling were Hodgson's attempts to provide a fatherly influence for Aaron, saying he encouraged him to read the Bible and open up about his past. I know for a fact that this was a total fabrication on his part. Aaron was no fan of the police, especially after being arrested with the threat of life in prison. The last person he wanted to talk to was a cop. He had three lawyers visiting him on a constant basis. I know from examining their work closely that they were not asleep at the wheel and would not have forgotten to mention something as basic as do not speak to law enforcement. I asked Aaron about this guy, and he said, "There's no way I would talk to him. He would always come around my cell trying to talk to me. He would say, 'I think if you open yourself up to me, you would feel better and life would be better for you.' I would just flip him the bird. In fact, that became almost a daily ritual. Hodgson would pass by his cell trying his best to get Aaron to talk. He would walk by his cell and say, 'Hey, Aaron, how are you today?' 'Fuck you, that's how I'm doing,' Aaron would answer. 'Okay, see you tomorrow,' Hodgson would press. 'Okay, fuck you very much,' Aaron would respond. This guy wouldn't shut up. He was still talking to the media years later when I came on the case, and he continued giving radio interviews after television cameras were long gone from his tiny jail. At one point, I came close to filing a motion against him and making a public statement, but I really didn't want to validate him by giving him the time of day. I'm sure he's still out there granting interviews to anyone who will listen. Aaron wasn't looking for a father figure while in jail. He was looking to survive, and that meant putting up a tough facade. Despite being isolated from most of the general population, he had plenty of fights and conflicts. At one point during his stay in the Bristol County Jail, he was charged with assaulting an inmate and threatening a guard. That's when Sheriff Hodgson decided he would be Dr. Phil and tried to diagnose Aaron. "I'm not a psychologist," he told Boston radio station WEEI on the day of Aaron's death. "I don't have any background in it, but I do think Aaron had some sociopathic tendencies." Aaron couldn't get away from Hodgson fast enough. A little more than a year after he was first arrested, his request to transfer away from Bristol County Jail was approved by a Massachusetts judge in July 2014. Not long after the Odin Lloyd trial began, Aaron guessed the outcome wasn't going to be favorable. He started to get dejected. After an 11-week trial, the jury deliberated for 7 days before returning a guilty verdict on April 15, 2015. The first-degree murder conviction in Bristol County Superior Court in Fall River, Massachusetts, carried a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole and automatically triggered an appeal to Massachusetts's highest court. Aaron had hoped to be going home that day. Instead, he mouthed the Shayana, be strong, as he was led away. A week later, he was transferred to Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center, a maximum security prison in Shirley, Massachusetts. He had gone from a $40 million contract to less than zero. He was 25 years old. Being behind bars is difficult enough for the average person, but it's compounded when you're a celebrity and you're big. Aaron was an expatriate in a maximum security prison where everyone knew it. Sousa Baranowski opened in 1998 as one of the most technologically advanced prisons in the United States. It was named after two corrections officers, James Sousa and Alfred Baranowski, who were shot in July 1972 by an inmate whose wife had smuggled a gun into what was then Norfolk Prison Colony. Sousa Baranowski, located 42 miles west of Boston, housed just over 1,000 criminally convicted adult males. Since its opening, the prison has seen suicides, attacks on the staff, fighting between inmates, and a riot on January 9, 2017, when a fight between two gang members erupted into 46 prisoners rioting in a housing unit for nearly 3 hours. It took a special operations unit using pepper spray to end the melee. When Aaron arrived at Sousa Baranowski following his conviction in the Lloyd case, he thought he had to project a tough guy image to survive. I'm fucked. My life is over, he told me of his attitude at the time. I'm going to spend the rest of my life here. In order to fit in and get some protection, he decided to join a prison gang. I should note here that when Aaron first got arrested, he was evaluated to see if he had any gang affiliations, and it was determined that he was not part of a gang. I have seen multiple reports and stories, including one written in Rolling Stone magazine, saying he was a member of the Bloods. This was directly contradicted by law enforcement investigation. The only gang he was a member of when he got arrested was the New England Patriots. However, prison survival was a different story. He thought maybe being part of a gang would give him some sense of belonging. When fights broke out, he'd know which side he was on. Within a month of being at Sousa Baranowski, he was disciplined for his involvement in a fight. According to an incident report released by the prison, he served as a lookout for another prisoner who had gone into an inmate's cell where they fought a bloody battle until the guards broke it up. Within his first 12 months in prison, Aaron was found with a 6-inch shank-like weapon. After that incident, he was removed from the general population and placed in the segregated unit. There, inmates were kept separate from all other inmates. He didn't care. After I took over the case, I can't count the times I would get word from him that he was placed in the hole because of people challenging him in prison and trying to break him. Or they perceived him as weak, a sure way to get killed or abused in prison. Aaron tried to maintain his tough front even though he had gone from a 7,100-square-foot home to a 7x10 jail cell. According to another incident report, he told officers, "This place ain't shit to me. I'll run this place and keep running shit. Prison ain't shit to me." At Bristol County Jail, Aaron was charged with 21 disciplinary offenses arising from 12 separate incidents, according to records. At the Sousa Baranowski prison, from his arrival in April 2015 to his death 2 years later, there were 78 more disciplinary offenses and 12 major incidents. There were at least 4 physical altercations. One time mace was used to break up a fight he was involved in. Prison life was awful. Keeping up a tough guy image was taking its toll. At one point, he was so despondent he got a large tattoo on his neck that read Lifetime. He got other tattoos as well, though they were against prison rules. He was known to experience periods of extreme frustration when he would kick and pound the door to his cell. He could also sit quietly by himself for long periods. Sometimes he had headaches. Sometimes he just wanted attention. He is constantly kicking his cell door and screaming at the top of his lungs, utilizing profanity at times when he wants something regardless of how minuscule it is, one Bristol County guard wrote in a report. It is not uncommon for Hernandez to kick his cell door constantly until an officer approaches his cell, merely to ask the officer for the current time. I wish I had reviewed these records when I started to represent him. I now believe these were clear signs that something was wrong with his brain. Angry, frustrated, and defiant, the only things Aaron looked forward to were his visits with Shayana. After one such visit, he thought about how much he loved Shayana and Aviel and how much he wanted to be with them again. He decided that he didn't have to die in jail. He started to read the Bible, the way his coach Urban Meyer and his quarterback Tim Tebow had shown him in college. Aaron found faith. He found hope. He told me that's when he decided that, "I want to fight this." He wasn't ready to give up. He told his fellow gang members he was out. "I'm not rolling with you anymore," he said. "If a fight breaks out, don't count on me." He would be tested again and he would have to fight again, but Aaron had a new outlook. He had another trial coming up in Boston. By May of 2014, a grand jury had indicted him on 2 counts of first-degree murder, 3 counts of armed assault with intent to murder, and an additional count of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon in the deaths of Daniel De Abreu and Safira Furtado in July 2012. When Aaron contacted me, he told me, "I hear you're the lawyer that wins cases that can't be won. I need your help, Jose. If I don't get it, I'm going to die in here." Yes, it was a long shot. But hope was the only thing keeping Aaron alive on the inside, and he wasn't ready to give up. Chapter 15. Family Matters. One aspect of the double homicide trial that bothered me and my team was the lack of support Aaron received from his family members. Shayana was there, driving from Rhode Island to Boston every day to attend the trial. Aaron was always so happy to see her. He would often turn to her and mouth, "I love you," or blow kisses to her. But she was the only one there consistently supporting Aaron. The families of the Cape Verdean victims were there daily. This concerned me because it sent a message to the jury that Aaron was the kind of person even his own family didn't love. The absence of family support upset Shayana greatly. "I feel like they gave up on him," she would tell me. "The money stopped. They didn't have their hometown hero like they wanted. I don't believe in that. There's no way I would have left him. There's no way I could have left him." Maybe his family thought it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to be found guilty in the Boston shootings after being convicted for the murder of Odin Lloyd. But to me, it was more evidence of the dysfunction that engulfed the family, once close-knit and prominent in their community. Aaron's father, Dennis, was the rock of the family. He was Aaron's hero. Dennis Hernandez was the son of Puerto Rican immigrants Bienvenido and Josephine Garcia Hernandez. He was born athletic and smart and had big dreams. Dennis was a football star long before his son tried to follow in his footsteps. He and his twin brother, David, excelled for Bristol Central High School in the 1970s. They were three sports stars who were also good at fighting, being two of the few Puerto Rican kids in an Irish-Italian community. Dennis was nicknamed the King, a sign of respect for the confident way he carried himself and the way he was revered. No one messed with the King. Dennis and his brother received scholarships to play football at nearby UConn. But Dennis liked to party and dabble in petty theft and wound up leaving the university before fulfilling his true potential. He would meet and marry Terry Valentine, a school secretary in Bristol, and they produced two boys, first DJ, then Aaron, born 3 years later on November 6, 1989. Employed as a custodian at Bristol Eastern High School, Dennis took great pleasure in watching his sons play sports and attending their games. He set up a gym where the boys could lift weights. Outside, there was a makeshift basketball court where they worked on their hoop skills into the night. Dennis was also fond of motivational sayings. He had not fulfilled his own destiny, but he would ensure his boys pursued theirs. One of his father's favorite quotes was tattooed on Aaron's arm. "If it is to be, it is up to me." Everyone in Bristol knew the Hernandez boys. Watching his sons play sports was Dennis's greatest joy, Terry once said. It was Dennis's vision that his boys would excel in sports, and each did. DJ, named for his father and grandfather, played 3 years as quarterback for UConn before being moved to wide receiver in 2007. Aaron looked to be following him. Wearing number 15 for the Bristol Central Rams, Aaron was a can't-miss Division I prospect. At 6'1", he had a good size and great hands. He also had speed, allowing him to break tackles and run through defenders. He was coachable and a good kid. All he wanted was to make his father happy and his older brother proud. Aaron and DJ were always mentioned in the same breath, even though DJ was older. They were joined at the hip while growing up, sharing the same bedroom and learning the lessons of being an athlete from their father. Their competition with each other made them better. They played football and basketball in the backyard, challenging each other the way brothers do. They worked out together and they raced against each other, running through the hills of Bristol chasing their father's dream. Terry was the disciplinarian of their single-story ranch-style home at 189 Greystone Avenue. She made sure the boys did their homework and were where they said they would be. With Dennis coaching the boys and her taking care of the home, they were a model American family. But in 2001, when Aaron was 12, Terry was arrested in a statewide sting for booking bets on sports. The New York Daily News reported she was a bookie for Marty Hovenesian, a restaurant manager in Bristol. She reportedly was paid $300 per week to accept wagers on professional football and baseball games, as well as the NBA and college basketball. According to the Daily News, the feds estimated more than $70,000 was wagered during 1 4-day span. She would then calculate the winnings and losings. A wiretap of her phone led to a search warrant, which led to her arrest. Hovenesian eventually pleaded guilty and was fined $10,000 for racketeering. Terry did no time, but in a small community like Bristol, everyone knew what had happened, and her actions brought shame on a family that had been highly regarded for the football prowess of her two sons. DJ tried to defend his mom, telling Sports Illustrated that she needed the money to buy her kids clothes and bicycles. "I'm not saying it was right what she did at all," he said. "I don't think it is. But this woman did this because I was crying every single night. She didn't do it for the thrill. She didn't do it to pocket money. She did it to provide for me and Aaron." Not long afterward, Terry shook the family again when it came to light that she was having an affair with a landscaper named Jeffrey Cummings. Cummings moonlighted as a drug dealer and happened to be married to Dennis's niece, Tanya Cummings, Aaron's cousin and his most loyal friend besides Shay. Being caught in a bookmaking scheme was bad enough. Now Terry was cheating on his father and betraying his cousin. Tanya was more like a sister to Aaron and shared his innermost secrets. He never quite felt that his mom was trustworthy. "Why do you think me and Tanya are so close?" Aaron once asked her during a telephone conversation from prison. "That's one of the reasons." Those feelings hardened when his father died in January of 2006. Dennis underwent a routine hernia operation and died unexpectedly from complications that began with an infection. He was 49. Aaron was just 16 and devastated. "It was more like a shock," Aaron said at the time. "Everyone was close to my father, but I was the closest. I was with him more than my friends. When that happened, who do I talk to? Who do I hang with? It was tough." More than 1,000 people attended the funeral services held at St. Matthew Roman Catholic Church in Bristol. Any donations were asked to be sent to the UConn Alumni Association. Everyone expresses their grief in different ways. DJ bawled his eyes out. Aaron hardly shed a tear during the funeral. "I saw a kid who was devastated," DJ would tell Sports Illustrated. "I think he was confused. He was lost. Crying is not always the answer, but being an emotional family, for him to put up a wall during the services, it was shocking to me. He was holding everything in." Shayana didn't really know the impact of his father's death until one day years later, when she and Aaron were in California, enjoying a quiet moment on the water. "We were talking, and I remember him getting emotional and crying," she said. "I saw Aaron cry maybe 3 times the entire time I knew him. We were talking about his father, and he was saying how much he missed him and how much he meant to him. With everything going on with him and his mother and who she married, Cummings, everything was coming to light. At that moment, I realized how much he was holding in and how much the impact of his father reflected on his life. I had no idea." Aaron felt alone and abandoned when his father died. His mother was already seeing another man, and his brother was in college. The situation at home grew worse when Cummings moved into the house where Terry lived with Aaron on Greystone Avenue. The couple got married as soon as he divorced Tanya, who at one point confronted Terry in the stands during a high school football game. Terry's connection to Cummings put a strain on Aaron's relationship with his mother and strengthened his bond with Tanya. Aaron remained very close to Tanya throughout her divorce ordeal, and long afterward, her children became his godsons, and later when she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, he promised to look after them. With Cummings around, Aaron took to the streets, hanging out in the rougher areas of Bristol. That's when he began to smoke marijuana more frequently to mask his pain. Still, he continued to excel in sports. He was a star player on the basketball team and a terror on the football field. At the end of a record-breaking career at Bristol Central High School that included 3,437 receiving yards and 45 receiving touchdowns, Aaron earned first-team All-State honors and led the Rams to the 2007 Central Connecticut Conference Southern Division Championship. He had verbally committed to UConn, but then Urban Meyer and the Gators called, and Aaron thought it might be good to get away from the cold and all the family drama and attend college at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He was recruited by Steve Adazio, an assistant coach at Florida who grew up just outside of Bristol. Aaron visited the campus for the 2006 spring game where he met Tim Tebow, a freshman quarterback from Jacksonville. Overwhelmed by the atmosphere of big-time football and the chance to play for a national championship, Aaron committed to Florida. Aaron left Bristol in January 2007, and like most freshmen, he was homesick and not sure he could handle the demands of school and playing sports. The death of his father still lay heavy on his heart. His father was his best friend. Aaron was depressed, and he carried that depression with him to Gainesville. Aaron spent the early part of his first year locked in his room sleeping. But later, after he got a taste of the nightlife and the perks of being a Gator, he started going to bars. He smoked weed and stopped going to class. He was the starting tight end for the Gators. He was still going to play because the team needed him, but the rest of his college career was in shambles. Meyer knew Aaron was still despondent over the death of his father and encouraged him to attend Bible study, which he did from time to time. The coach also asked Mike and Marquise Pouncey, twin offensive linemen, to make sure he stayed out of trouble, and also asked Tebow to keep an eye on him. That was often easier said than done. There was a well-publicized incident in 2007 at a bar near campus. Aaron, in a group according to records that included Tebow, reportedly had an argument with a waiter, Michael Taphorn, who suffered a ruptured eardrum in an ensuing scuffle. No charges were filed, and in the larger context of college football misbehavior, the conflict was a non-event. But word made its way back to the coach. Aaron came under scrutiny again when he was suspended for Florida's 2008 season opener against Hawaii. Meyer would later say Aaron was benched because he failed a drug test. This was the only drug test on record that Aaron officially failed, though he was known to be heavy into weed and would later have to address it at the NFL scouting combine. Meyer has taken criticism for covering up Aaron's transgressions while at Florida, but in my opinion, he shouldn't be blamed. Coaching should be about helping kids grow into emotionally strong men and women, not just physically strong athletes. But every member of the university administration, not just coaches, should encourage their student athletes to seek counseling for their personal crises. The fact is, being a college football coach means not only preparing students for game days, but also steeling yourself for their arrest warrants. During an interview with HBO's Real Sports, Meyer acknowledged that there had been 31 arrests of 25 players under his watch at Florida. Charges aren't often pursued if the team is winning national championships. But regardless, college programs have law enforcement on speed dial for when athletes get in trouble. Truth is, Aaron had a good relationship with Meyer and his wife, Shelley. She told Real Sports when she saw Aaron arrested in the Odin Lloyd case that her immediate thought was, "That's not the Aaron Hernandez I know." She said, "Aaron Hernandez was in my home many, many times, sitting with my kids, playing with my kids. Yes, ma'am, Miss Shelley. It's just excruciatingly sad to see a kid that we know that was part of our family make decisions that are just horrible." When Aaron was arrested in the Odin shooting, every questionable deed he committed in Florida was brought to the surface. He was also mentioned in the double shooting that took place in Gainesville in 2007, where 5 gunshots were fired into a car containing 3 passengers stopped at a traffic light. The occupants of the car described the shooter as a Hawaiian or Hispanic male with a large build and many tattoos. Aaron was contacted by police, but he invoked his right to counsel and refused to talk to them. No charges were filed, largely because police reports indicate every witness to the shooting, other than those directly involved, identified the shooter as a black man under 6 feet tall with cornrows and wearing a green polo shirt. Aaron said he was innocent, but the idea he was the shooter persisted. "I was among those who assumed he was involved, but Aaron insisted he wasn't. He told me he had interacted with the group that day, that somebody had snatched a chain off of one of the pouncies and there had been a lot of tough talk back and forth. But there was another group of guys who had a beef with the victims, and they must have done the shooting. He had not." "I'm serious," he said. Aaron had told me so much at this point, good, bad, and ugly, that he seemed shocked that I didn't initially believe him. "Why do you think I would lie to you like that?" he asked. "Come on," I told him. "You were at least in the car. You were at least part of it." "No," he said. "I literally had nothing to do with that. I wasn't anywhere near the shooting." I guess I was just as guilty as everyone else passing judgment on him, assuming he was involved. He said he had participated in the initial talking shit part, but after that he and the twins took off. I believe him now. There were times he told me things he didn't have to tell me, behavior of his that was questionable. There were many times when I expected an innocent answer and he would respond with a shockingly candid admission. That's why I felt he was always ultimately truthful with me. While there may have been doubt about his behavior off campus, there was little question about his performance on the football field. He was playing well and getting along with his teammates. His Gator teammates nicknamed him Chico because he was the only Puerto Rican on the team. Aaron liked the nickname and even got a little jealous when players started calling a new equipment manager Chico too. "I thought I was the only Chico," Aaron complained. After catching 9 passes for 111 yards in Florida's 51-24 win over Cincinnati in the Sugar Bowl, Aaron announced in January 2010 that he was declaring himself for the NFL draft. Meyer had already told him he wouldn't be welcomed back for his senior year, but he had played well enough during his junior season to be considered one of the best prospects at tight end. "It is really special for me to take this first step toward my lifelong dream of playing in the NFL on the 4th anniversary of my father's passing," Aaron said at the time. "I know he would be proud of not only me, but of my whole family, whose love and support are the only reasons I am where I am today. My 3 years in Florida provided me with the foundation I need to succeed as a player and a person." Aaron signed with the sports agency Athletes First and began to prepare for the NFL scouting combine in Indianapolis. This is the annual showcase where all potential college candidates for the upcoming NFL draft assemble and are put through physical and mental exercises for careful evaluation. Coaches, scouts, and general managers from every franchise in the National Football League are on hand to dissect every player's statistics and test scores and use the information to decide which players they will draft in April. The prospects are there by invitation only and have often spent several weeks training daily in preparation for the showcase, hoping a good showing will increase their draft stock. Since rookie contracts are tied to draft position, the higher a player is drafted, the more money he'll make. Some players are just hoping to be drafted during the 7 rounds of selections. Those who go undrafted are free to sign with the team of their choice if they're wanted. When it came time to perform in Indy, Aaron couldn't. A back injury prevented him from competing in the drills, but he did go through the interviews with several different teams interested in him. He would work out during a pro day at the University of Florida, but concerns about his drug use and off-the-field incidents lingered, and Aaron dropped to the 4th round, where he was selected by the Patriots. His first professional contract would earn him $596,000 as a rookie and $650,000 the following year. A few days after being drafted, he showed up on Shayana's doorstep. They had attended Southside Elementary School together, but didn't really interact until they were classmates at Memorial Boulevard, a middle school in Bristol that no longer exists. They became sweethearts in high school. Aaron was already a jock and a class clown, while Shayana was captain of the high school dance team and a sprinter on the track team. Their relationship was off and on while he was in Florida, but Aaron, who had moved to Plainview, Massachusetts after leaving college, was a pro now and looking for stability. "Ultimately, we ended up with each other," said Shayana, who was working as a phlebotomist. "I moved to Plainview with him, and I was driving back and forth from Massachusetts to Connecticut for my job." Meanwhile, in 2010, police were summoned to the home Terry and Cummings were sharing. Cummings had grabbed an 8-inch knife and made a 3.5-inch cut on Terry's right cheek after pushing her to the floor during an argument in the family kitchen. Cummings was arrested and ultimately sent to prison for 2 years. The couple divorced, but renewed their volatile relationship once Cummings was released. Aaron kept his focus on football, and in his second season, the Patriots reached the Super Bowl, and the Hernandez family was the toast of Bristol again. There was a celebration in the gym at Southside Elementary where Terry worked as a secretary to the principal. There were balloons, banners, and posters. Teachers wore t-shirts that read, "Go Patriots," from the hometown of Aaron Hernandez. Terry was given a bouquet of flowers and a sash that read, "Super Bowl Mom." A video featuring Aaron was played as tears fell onto the cheeks of his proud mother. "Make sure you listen to your teachers," Aaron said in the video. Somewhere in the heavens, Dennis had to be smiling. His son had reached the ultimate stage in football just like he had envisioned. What began in the backyard of their home in Bristol had reached the Super Bowl. Aaron caught a touchdown pass in the big game, but the Giants won, sending the Patriots home as losers and denying Aaron a Super Bowl ring. But he had played well enough over his first 2 seasons to earn a $40 million extension, which he signed during the offseason. He was living his father's dream. Unlike most ballers who have just struck it rich, Aaron didn't immediately go out and buy his mother a house. Instead, Terry remained in her home with Cummings. Aaron bought himself a house, the large mansion in North Attleboro, into which he eventually moved with Shayana. They got engaged in October 2012 during her baby shower. Everyone knew what was about to happen except Shayana. "He sat next to me and was helping me open the last of the gifts," Shayana recalled. "I thought he was getting up to thank everybody for coming, and he started with a speech, and I figured out what was going on. It was a special moment for us." On November 6th, Aviel arrived on Aaron's birth date. "The grinning football star was there from the beginning of my contractions to the birth of Aviel," Shayana would say. He seemed more interested in the process than anything. A few days after Aviel's birth, the family gathered everything they owned and moved it into the big house, as Shay called it. "Everything happened really fast," she said. "Him signing the contract, us getting pregnant, and us moving into our home happened within a few months." Their dreams of a wonderful life as a family were turned upside down that morning in June of 2013 when Aaron was arrested and charged with the murder of Odin Lloyd. When Aaron was charged with shooting Odin Lloyd, Terry was still working at Southside Elementary and wondering how things had gone so wrong. Despite the strained relationship with her son, she was a daily presence during the Lloyd trial and constantly maintained her son's innocence. "All I can say is that he will be cleared of all these charges in the end," she said at the time. "Let it play out until the end." She was there weeping alongside Shay when the guilty verdict was read. When a husband, son, or brother is torn from their home and jailed, it's not just the prisoner who suffers. The entire family is affected. But after that, it seemed Aaron's family wanted to distance themselves from him. Aaron's mother was never seen at the Boston trial, an absentee figure I'm sure was noticed by the jury. DJ wasn't really there either. After the conviction, DJ started going by Jonathan, his middle name. Jonathan presents a story of an older brother who never abandoned his younger brother. He told Sports Illustrated that he often talked to his brother by telephone at the Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center. But when Aaron needed him at the Boston trial, he was reluctant to attend. DJ, or Jonathan, showed up for one day of the Boston trial, but that was only because the prosecution had subpoenaed him as a potential witness to testify. Aaron was happy to see his brother, but knew the real reason he was there. It wasn't really to support him. Aaron told us that when he and DJ were kids, they were competitive, and Aaron always felt he had to do something to earn his big brother's attention and love. He felt that with other members of his family, there was always something he had to do or give to gain their love. He once told my associate Michelle Medina that he never felt he was loved without a string attached. Now that Aaron was in prison, he could see who really supported him because he had nothing to give back. Aaron smiled at his brother the one day he showed up. Little did either know, it would be the last time they would see each other. We could never get his mother, Terry, to the trial. My office called her several times, asking her to come down to see Aaron. She would call our office and leave messages with concerns about security at the courthouse and what the media would say about her attendance and how the media would portray her. Here was a man fighting for his freedom who needed his mother's love, but she was more concerned about what the press would say. Aaron was frustrated by his mother's absence and assumed she didn't show up because she didn't want her arrest for being a bookie to be rehashed again. Aaron always thought his mother was an informant who cooperated with the cops because she got a slap on the wrist while others were convicted and fined. He knew she must have cooperated with authorities, and deep down, he wasn't proud of that. I can tell you that Aaron did love his mother, but he was so frustrated by the way she showed her love. A transcript of a phone conversation the two shared while Aaron was in prison shows the dynamic. Aaron, there's so many things I'd like. I would love to talk to you about so you can know me as a person, but I never could tell you, and you're going to die without even knowing your son. That's the craziest thing about it. You know what I mean? It's crazy. Terry. Well, if you feel you can't talk to me. Aaron. How could I? How could I? You are not trustworthy at all. Terry. Well, Aaron. It's so sad. You know? Later in the conversation, Aaron says, I just wish I could be closer with you, but I can't and it kills me. But I can't. It's just, it is what it is. I just have to deal with it. Terry. But babe, after 9 years, we're both hurt. Aaron, it's not even about being hurt, Ma. It's just like, I don't know. There's just so much stuff I would love to just talk to my mom about, but I can't, because I know you'll tell. Near the end of the conversation, Aaron says again, you'll die not knowing your son, and I think that's really sad. Terry never made it to the trial. Aaron's uncle David came to court once and brought his wife and kids. David was going through cancer treatment and was very sick. His cousin Jennifer was there for a day and brought along Tanya Singleton's kids, Jano and Eddie, the two names Aaron referred to in one of his notes the night he committed suicide. He had promised Tanya he would take care of them when she died of cancer. Besides Aviel, they were his world. Aaron was the kind of man who would ask everyone he met about their families. He would ask how my kids were doing, and he wasn't just paying lip service. Family was important to him. In the end, Shay and Aviel were his family. He would often pull out the picture of Shay and Aviel he carried with him in his coat pocket during the trial as a good luck charm. He would brag about Aviel and say, she's so beautiful. She looks just like me, right? Every time he saw Shay in court supporting him, he would say, I love this girl. He was always trying to turn around and say to her, I love you. That's what drove him, love and hope. That's what drove Shayana, too. Every single time he came out of the holding cell into the courtroom and saw me, Aaron lit up, she said. Stuff like that gives you butterflies. You're thinking, how could I ever not support this man? I didn't understand how a family that was once so supportive and so loving and so tight could leave him like that.
I wish I had a better relationship with them so I could ask them.
You're supposed to fight for what's right. They just quit. There was a lot of selfish behavior. You can't be there all the time. But not once? It's just sad. Chapter 16. Would you please convict if there's no evidence? As we began speaking to potential jurors individually, I could immediately see how different picking a jury was going to be in Boston. Boston is a mecca of American higher education, home to universities like Harvard, MIT, Boston College. The list goes on and on. This natural abundance of higher education was reflected in its jury pool. We started taking hardship requests from jurors, and I couldn't believe the number of doctors and surgeons who had commitments that precluded them from serving. We were reviewing requests in a small anteroom outside of the main jury pool room. While many potential jurors had legitimate reasons to be excused, an almost comical number seemed to feel they didn't have to perform their civic duty simply because they were doctors. The absurdity reached its zenith when a pharmacist walked in and said he couldn't serve because he was a pharmacist. "If you were required to serve, how would you be affected?" Judge Locke asked. "Well, my patients would not receive their proper medication, and there could be many sick people who desperately need their medicine," answered the good pharmacist. "And are there no other pharmacists that work in the pharmacy where you work?" Locke pressed. "Well, yes, but I know how to fill the prescriptions better, because I know how my patients like their prescriptions," answered the man. That one left us all scratching our heads. Locke made him wait until the end of the day before excusing him. All students got a free pass, as many would miss class and finals, and with all the universities and specialty schools in Boston, that eliminated about half our pool right there. The process was painfully slow and careful. We had done months of preparation for jury selection. We had a detailed questionnaire prepared that all jurors were asked to fill out, and we had a team of interns in a hotel room nearby working around the clock to search public and not-so-public records to get further background information on potential jurors. We had another group of kids scouring the internet and social media sites to get all the available information we could. George Leontire was in charge of compiling all the data and identifying the group of jurors we were looking for. Once we were done with the hardships, we moved straight to the individual questioning of each potential juror. The mood was fairly light throughout the week until a Hispanic-looking man walked in looking quite somber. He spoke with a thick accent, and I quickly realized he wasn't Hispanic. He was Cape Verdean. That was an immediate disqualification for the defense, but we could not excuse someone because of race, or in this case, ethnicity. Soon we realized he not only knew the Cape Verdeans and the BMW, but he was Daniel de Abreu's uncle. I felt terrible for the man as we questioned him, and he broke down and began to cry. The man clearly wanted to do his civic duty. He felt it was an honor to serve on a jury. Yet he was honest enough to know there was no way for him to be fair to Aaron. Then he shocked the entire room when he turned to Aaron, looked him in the eye, and said, "I want you to receive a fair trial." The next issue we covered was how much press coverage the potential jurors had seen. We were sure not to mention the Odin Lloyd case until the potential juror indicated he or she had seen media coverage of both cases, and an overwhelming majority of them had. I was shocked by how much of the Odin Lloyd case some of these potential jurors recalled. Some could even recite some of the witnesses' names and what their relationship was to the people involved. But some didn't know much at all, and a few knew even less than they thought. A well-dressed, middle-aged white woman walked in and was questioned about her exposure to the media. When asked by Judge Locke if she had been exposed to some of the media coverage about this case, she responded proudly, "Yes, I have." "What exactly have you seen?" Locke asked. "Well, isn't this the case about Deflategate?" This drew laughs from everyone, including the press, who were familiar with the New England Patriot quarterback Tom Brady's suspension from the NFL for allegedly deflating some footballs during games in order to gain tactical advantage. The poor woman's face was flushed with embarrassment when Locke broke it to her that she was not there to pass judgment about deflated footballs. Jury selection should really be called jury deselection, because it's more a process of elimination than anything else. The way the process works is that each side can strike a juror for cause. Cause is usually a constitutional challenge questioning whether the person should serve. For instance, they admit they can't be fair, or they have some form of bias. Either side can move to strike a juror selection, or the judge can do it. Then each side is given a certain number of cause challenges, allowing them to question why the other side has struck a juror. Most states give each side 12 strikes, called peremptory challenges. These allow a party to strike a juror for any reason they choose other than for race, religion, or gender, which would violate the juror's constitutional rights. Peremptory challenges are one of the few tools given to a defense lawyer because prosecutors always, and I mean always, strike African Americans from juries. That's mainly because African Americans face so much discrimination in our criminal justice system that most are predisposed to distrust the police, the main witnesses for the state. What I find amusing is that prosecutors will never admit to excusing jurors because of their race, but the practice is plain as day, and they get so upset and indignant when you call them out on it. Again, like Captain Renault from Casablanca, they are shocked, shocked if you insinuate their actions are racist, but they do it anyway. I never let a prosecutor strike a person of color without forcing them to state their reasons. This is called a Batson challenge. Never. Because I want the prosecutor to know that I will guard against racism like a pit bull. Prosecutor Mark Lee, who was leading the jury selection process for the prosecution, was a bit thrown off when I made my first Batson challenge. Once we raise the Batson challenge, we then request that the prosecutor give a race-neutral explanation for why they are excusing the juror. If the judge finds the reason to be